My guest today is Professor Joel Batten, who is an author, filmmaker, and a professor of law at the University of British Columbia. His work examines the social, economic, and political dimensions of law. Welcome, Joel.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. So you have a book out. It's called The New Corporation. And I found this, I just skimmed through it. I found it fascinating. Just to put my bias on the table before we start, Joel, I had a brief appetizer at the University of Chicago. So the Chicago School, as one might call it. Sure. I looked through things with that glasses, you know, with that colored Chicago glasses. But I always argue that, you know, the Chicago School is not well understood by the public. What we mean are different things from what the public thinks, what people mean. So getting to the book, so the new corporation, you say here. So before we get into the details of it, so what is the book about, The New Corporation?
Right. So I wrote a book and made a film in the early 2000s called The Corporation. And in it, I had the great honor to interview somebody who you'll know well if you are a subscriber to the Chicago School, which is Professor Milton Friedman. And in that interview, Professor Friedman and I agreed very strongly on the basic premise that a corporation is created to generate wealth for its shareholders and not to pursue social and environmental causes and values. And the reason I say we agree with that is because for Professor Friedman, that was a prescriptive idea, namely that a corporation shouldn't be doing that as an economist. For me as a lawyer, it was a descriptive idea in the sense that corporate law requires corporations always to pursue their own best interests, meaning the collective interests of their shareholders, and not to pursue anything else, including social and environmental values. So while he was coming from the left and I was from the right, pardon me, and I was coming from the left, yes, we both agreed on that point. And the whole point of my book was to, in the early 2000s and the film, was to make the argument that corporations really were limited to simply creating wealth for their shareholders and investors. And that to the extent they were saying, which they were starting to at that time, that they were socially responsible and committed to making the world a better place and all of that, they were actually lying and that we shouldn't be deceived by them. And Milton Friedman basically said the same thing. And my argument was it's really therefore up to governments, to democratic governments, to pursue those social and environmental values and to shape and regulate the economy to make sure that it protects and promotes those values rather than destroys those values. And as Professor Friedman wrote in the New York Times, he basically agreed with that idea that the division of labor was that government should deal with those things, corporations with others. Okay, so that's the early 2000s. Yeah. My new book and film, The New Corporation, is made in, was produced in 2020. And basically, it is because what I realized over the ensuing years between the first project and the second was that everything I talked about in the first had gotten worse. Corporations had gotten bigger, more powerful, were having a more destructive impact on the world. And so therefore, it was time for a new look at what was going on. And when I took that look, what I realized was not only had corporations become bigger and more destructive, but they had really doubled down on the idea that they were now the saviors of the world. It was no longer just this notion that we'll try to be a bit more socially responsible, but now they were saying you should rely on us to solve climate change, to solve economic inequality, and by implication, you shouldn't really rely on governments anymore. We're now appropriately taking control. So that's kind of a quick recap on how that all came about.
Yeah, I found fascinating. So, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, one could argue, since we can sort of step back and say, what's objective function for society, right? So I want to sort of start there and then go from there. So what's the societal objective function? Is it sort of maximizing happiness, maximizing utility in some way? What is your perspective on that?
Yeah. Well, I think ultimately the function of society and the government that we elect and the institutions that we and those governments create, including markets and corporations, is to promote, however you want to describe it, the social good. Now, the social good means that we want to promote happiness for people. We want to promote utility in the sense that we want to promote things that people need and use. And we want to promote security. We want to promote health. We want to promote all of those social goods. Now, the problem with capitalism as a whole is capitalism doesn't say that. Capitalism says the function of society is to produce capital. And it has a theory that if we produce capital, then that will trickle down to creating social good. Mm. But social good is not an end in itself. The telos, or the end of capitalism, is to create capital. And that telos is legally embedded in the institution of the corporation. And that, I think, is where the problem starts. We have a confusion of ends and means. We operate in this model where we assume the function of our main institutions, of our governments, of our society, is to create capital, and that somehow social good will follow from that. Now, of course, socialism says the function of our society is to create social good. And yes, we can have markets, but the markets are tools for creating social good. And so it's really about means and ends. Neither capitalism nor socialism dispense with either social good or markets, but they each see the means and ends in relation to those as being the obverse of the other. And and that, I think, is the place that we're at now. That's why we're so confused as a society.
Yeah. Confusion is a right term. Is it sort of maximizing utility, or is it maximizing the slope of utility? What I mean is that we got 8 billion people. Half of them, I think you talk about this in the book, make say $2-3 a day. Some of them are happy, actually, happier than the few billionaires or trillionaires. We have a few trillionaires now, much happier than them, actually. They make a few dollars a day and they're happy. So happiness is not correlated with wealth. No. It seems to have some sort of negative correlation, or maybe some sort of inverted U type function, right? So I'm sort of looking at the whole system again and saying, you know, so if you were the emperor of the world, managing 8 billion people, how would you do this? What would be the function? What would be the objective function?
Yeah, I mean, I think today we talk a lot about division and difference. We talk about how this group is different than that group, and how we identify this way or that way. We talk less about commonality and what those 8 million people, despite their gender and race and sexuality differences and whatnot, what unites them? What do they have in common in terms of, to put it in your terms, a kind of formula for happiness? And needless to say, I'm glad I'm not emperor of the world, and I think the world is probably glad of it too. But what I would say from a start, just based on my observation of the world, is that it's very hard to find happiness if you don't have health. It's very hard to find happiness if you don't have food to put on the table, if you don't have clean water, if you're living in a war zone. There are some very obvious things about what the constituents of happiness are. And I would add to that, the person who's making $2 to $3 a day may be happy, but perhaps they're in a system where they have healthcare, where they have opportunities for recreation, where they have opportunities for love, and where they're not worried about whether they and their family are going to starve, and on and on and on. So I think that at a minimum, and I think, as I say, we've lost sight of this in talking so much about what our differences are. We need some measure of security, and it doesn't have to come through wages in the market. It can come through services that are provided on a non-market basis. It can come through some combination of those things. And yes, we're always going to have inequality. And as emperor of the world, I'm going to acknowledge that we're never going to be able to solve that. We're not always going to all have the same thing. But the idea is that we should all have enough that we don't suffer the indignities and the deprivations that make it impossible for us to have hope, for us to have joy, for us to have security. And our current system, unfortunately, doesn't come close to delivering that basic minimum that enables us to have happiness. And I think once we have that basic minimum, I mean, yeah, you can find a bunch of billionaires who are absolutely miserable, who have social difficulties, mental health difficulties, relationship difficulties.
I would love to be a miserable billionaire, by the way.
Yeah. You know? Well, I don't know. Maybe you wouldn't. I mean, the point is, you may be quite a bit happier than you would be if you had billions of dollars. So I think that is the thing. I mean, your point's absolutely right that money is not a recipe for happiness. But I think what is a necessity for happiness is having some measure of security and predictability in your life and some basis for hope and joy. That I think is necessary.
Yeah, so I'm just sort of condensing, you know, what you have been talking on the book. So there's a hierarchy of needs, and the needs, you know, given 8 billion scope is very complex. I mean, we can't really understand. We have 200 countries, 8 billion people. They have different objective functions. You know, it's very, very difficult even for United Nations to really get into it. So we have a hierarchy of needs. The question is, can we have any impact on that hierarchy in some way, right? From an optimization perspective, I'm just trying to make it mathematical. So what's your thinking on that?
Yeah, I mean, what we do as a society is, as a complex society, whether we're talking about the country I live in, Canada, or we're talking about the United States or Somalia or any country, or we're talking about the global order, or we're talking about regional orders, we create modes of organization that are, at least theoretically, designed to try to optimize the opportunities of people and the realities of people to flourish in their lives. And so we create institutions like democratic government. We create public transit systems. We create private for-profit corporations, and we create markets. I mean, markets are not part of nature. They're created by legal norms, by laws of contract and property and all of that. So all of these institutions are created with the objective, theoretically and ideally, of providing the most that we can for everybody in terms of opportunities for lives that flourish. So where I see my point of intervention is in trying to understand at least one of these institutions in realistic terms, as opposed to mythic terms. And so my work is aimed at trying to hold the reality of what a for-profit publicly traded corporation is against the mythology that's created by everybody, really, by government, by advertisers, by corporations themselves, by pundits, by organizations, whether it's the World Economic Forum or the Business Roundtable or whatever, all of these organizations whose role, or part of whom's role, is to create stories about what the corporation is. And the story that's been created of late is radically inaccurate because it's a story about an institution that says, you know what, this institution used to be about just making money and exploiting people and planet to do so, but now it's about saving people and planet and providing all kinds of social and environmental benefits to society. And my argument is very simple. It's that change never happened. Yeah. When you look at the institutional composition and constitution of the corporation, it is the money-making machine that we used to be honest about saying it was, but now we've shifted into this place. And a consequence of that shift is that we've said because corporations are publicly minded, then we don't need to worry about regulating them as much because we can trust they'll do the right thing. And we can let them run our schools and our water systems because now they're publicly oriented. And so now we're confusing corporations with the qualities that we usually ascribe to an institution that can govern us. And to me, that's a very dangerous move. And that's what I'm challenging in my book and film.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me. So you talk about investment banking CEO. I don't want to mention any names here. I have heard this also, that, you know, people want to change the world. I mean, we had Microsoft, Bill Gates giving nets to us, to Africa, to curtail malaria. Which is a great idea. But a better idea would be getting a malaria vaccine. But that takes a bit more money, you know. So it is very unclear to me that, and I think that's your point in the book, that you go out and you get eyeballs and you get press, you know, talking about, you know, you need to save Detroit, you talk about in the book.
Yeah. I mean, we can name him Jamie Dimon. Yeah. If we mention Bill Gates, we can mention Jamie Dimon.
Yes. But at the end of the day, the only thing that matters are the results, right? So are you improving the utility or the happiness of a population? It's the only thing that matters. Nothing else really matters, right?
Of course. All that matters is the result. But there are two problems along the way. One is, what results are we aiming for? And two is, what is the best way to achieve those results? And going back to the 17th century and the beginning of the European Enlightenment, many philosophers were saying, including Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill and Rousseau and all of these other folks, was that given that the results and the methods by which we try to achieve them are always contentious.
Yeah.
We need a way to take that out of the hands of the nobility, no matter how well-intentioned they might be, and put it into the hands of the people, and hence into democratic hands. That was the sort of basic conceit of the ideas of the Enlightenment and the ideas that our present institutions of government are structured around. And so when we say we'll let Bill Gates, you know, solve malaria, or we'll let Jamie Dimon save Detroit or whatever, the problem there is that we are saying, in effect, that we are totally beholden to and subject to what these men happen to think is important, what they think is more important than other things, and going back to vaccine versus other programs, what they think is the best way to pursue that objective. And so by saying, okay, well, we're fine with that, we're basically undoing the last 300 years of enlightened thinking about trying to move to systems that are more reflective of and responsive to what the people democratically want and demand.
Right. Yes, I'm a bit conflicted about this. So I came to the US in the mid 80s with $40. And so when I was 10 years old, it was US or bust for me. And when I came here, it was Jimmy Carter who was the president. I thought that guy was great. You know, I was a civil engineer. He was also a civil engineer. It's an amazing thing that you can attract people from all around the world to come somewhere and assimilate and do things. And that happens only in the sort of the capitalistic framework, I would say. So I'll just put that out to you to respond to
sure,
it.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think I am not a critic of markets. I think markets and market systems are far preferable to non-market systems. I think communism is a kind of fundamentalism that I don't agree with, and I think is actually really bad. I'm in favor of a system that tries to mix public provision and public norms with private initiative and all the good things that come with that. And I think, you know, that is really the sweet spot, is to try to find the best mix of markets and public guidance and regulation and provision. And nobody in Jimmy Carter's world was saying that we should move to pure capitalism. That would wait for Reagan, who followed Jimmy Carter, right? And I mean, Jimmy Carter was all about trying to find that mix. And then when Reagan came to power, he specifically said, well, we don't really want that mix anymore. Now we're going to go completely in the direction of markets, even though he never did, and nobody ever does. There was still tons of government spending, particularly on military, and all of the trickle down that came from that. So, but that's a different issue. But essentially, Reagan was articulating and prescribing a kind of fundamentalism that was the mirror image of the fundamentalism that communism is. So we have a market fundamentalism on the one side, and we have a sort of public provision fundamentalism on the other side. In the market
And Thatcher,
Reagan in this country, Brian Mulroney, and Modi in India would be a current example of that view.
Yeah.
So, you know, my view is that markets are a very effective tool when used with the view that they are a tool. And I think the problem with the kind of market fundamentalism that we experience today is that, again, it confuses the means and the ends. It sees markets as ends. It sees the production of capital as an end, when in fact, those things should be seen as tools for serving the social good. So I'm completely in favor of markets as tools. And I think that's what, when I hear you saying that, you know, capitalism creates a system. I mean, my grandparents came over when they were 14 years old with nothing in their pockets too. And they were able to benefit from the system that the United States was back in the 1930s, and et cetera. And in particular from the New Deal, which, you know, they were in the garment industry, and the New Deal allowed them to form unions and protect their interests and get decent wages and all of that. So it was that mixture of public regulation and markets that that really led to, in many ways, the greatness of the United States.
Yeah, it remains to be, for me, the greatest country ever conceived. We're about to lose it.
Well,
we might completely lose it in 6 months. I don't know. That would be the end of it. So I'm still staying optimistic.
Well, good for you.
The next 6 months, yeah.
Good for you. I mean, in my book, I wrote my book in 2020, and I tried to grapple with the question of why that kind of illiberal populism that Donald Trump represents, and we see it in other countries too, why it is appealing to so many people. And this would be true in India too, again with Modi, and it's true in
Hungary. It's a mirror image. It's a total mirror image.
It's mirror image. Yeah. It's true in Italy. It's true, you know, it's becoming truer and truer in many places. And so the question is why? And the argument I make in my book is that 40 years of market fundamentalism, or what many people call neoliberalism, of democracy and democratic governments relinquishing their duty to try to promote some measure of social equality and social solidarity led to basically the complete exclusion of many, many, many people, which made them very, very angry. And that anger then gets channeled by demagogues like Donald Trump. And so, you know, the book is an argument not only about the corporation, but about the system that it's helped create, that I think has led us inevitably down this path.
Yeah, so, you know, I was just thinking, Joel, that I grew up as a Catholic in South India. So with Modi's program, I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen there. Mm. And I'm a brown-skinned person in the U.S. Mm. with Trump's program, I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen in the U.S. So I'm sort of left in the middle. I went to Portugal, I went to Budapest, I went to New Zealand. I was looking for another place where I could go if things really go bad in both directions. And I think there are a lot of people like that, I think. What do you
think? Well, I certainly know from just anecdotal experience, I can't tell you how many of my American friends have said, you know, on November 10th or whatever, what do you think the prospects would be for emigrating to Canada? And, you know, there are a lot of people, I think, who are feeling uncomfortable about what could happen. And, you know, unfortunately, history is not a comfort. Where, you know, especially the rise of European fascism happened through electoral systems, happened in not dissimilar circumstances of sort of massive inequality and dislocation and unemployment and inflation and all of that. So I have to say, I am shocked at at what has happened in the United States and in other countries yeah. that have gone in that direction. Yeah. I would never have predicted it 15 years ago, but with hindsight, and as I argue in my book, we created the conditions that were fertile ground for this kind of demagoguery and xenophobia. Anyways, if you think of New Zealand and Hungary and Portugal, you can think of you can think of Canada too. But I think the weather's a lot better in Portugal. So are you from Kerala?
I am, yeah. So yeah. The Portugal Prime Minister right now is from Goa.
Right.
And that's some of the reason I looked at Lisbon. I mean, it seemed pretty interesting. So let's talk about the book again. So Davos, you talk a lot about Davos, the economic conference. What's the right term? The economic summit?
The World Economic Forum.
The World Economic, yeah, okay. So Davos, all the people that we know assemble in, is Davos in Switzerland?
Yes.
Yeah, that's appropriate. They assemble in Switzerland and they talk about how to make the world better, right?
Yeah.
And have they made the world better?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, they have a particular model for what that better world would look like, which is why I went to Davos. There are a lot of people, sort of conspiracy theorists and whatnot, who talk about Davos as this, you know, grand conspiracy to control the world. I don't think it's that at all. And that's not why I went there. I do think it is, as you suggest, a place where the sort of economic and government and NGO elites get together once a year and really grapple yeah. with the state of the world. And under the leadership of Klaus Schwab, an economist himself.
And that was the last Davos conference you're talking about?
Well, all of them are under Klaus Schwab's leadership.
Oh, okay.
It started in the 1970s, and it's always been his sort of baby. I went in 2018, and I went with a film crew, so that when you watch the documentary, you'll see all kinds of scenes from Davos and characters from Davos and whatnot. And I talk about them in the book as well. And the reason I went is because the Davos combines two key ideas that I think are quite dominant among global elites these days. One is that corporations and markets are becoming and should be benevolent, that they are not just about making money, but they are about serving social and environmental goods and solving social and environmental problems. And the second argument is that, or the second idea is that they should be more prominent in doing that, and government should be less prominent in doing that. So it really is, there is a kind of overarching ethos at Davos. Yeah. And I'm not saying everybody there ascribes to this. There are some people who criticize it. I talked to some of them in the movie and in the book. But there's an overarching sense that, in a way, to put it in a term, it's time to privatize government. And it's okay to privatize governance because now the private actors are on board with trying to make a better world. They're no longer just selfishly involved in making money. And so it's that view that I criticize, that I suggest is highly inaccurate and dangerously inaccurate, and that actually operates as a patina, as a way of obscuring what is really going on in global capitalism.
So what would be the practical path to privatize government? I mean, is this an abstract notion or is it practical?
Oh, I think it's very practical. I mean, the example that is a very direct and literal example that we look at in the film is Jamie Dimon bailing out Detroit. He's basically taking on the task of of having a bank, in effect, run a city, make decisions about what the priorities are, whether it should be a cultural venue or public transit, or, you know, and all of a sudden, Detroit is an investment rather than a demos, rather than a democratic place where the people are supposed to be deciding what's going on. Now, you know, there's no question that Detroit was in absolute despair economically. But as I point out in the film and book, part of the reason for that had to do with J.P. Morgan's shenanigans, for which, you know, they were civilly and criminally held liable, that led to the 2008 economic meltdown, from which Detroit never recovered. So there's this strange kind of circularity where this major bank effectively destroys a city and then comes in to save it, and effectively to privatize its governance. And I would say it's the same thing when you have, as you do quite commonly in the United States, private entities running school systems, private entities running water systems, private entities being in partnership with government to set priorities and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so in some sense, capitalism is not very well defined, in the sense that, so capitalism, you know, the way that I understood when I was in Chicago was that the rules apply equally to everybody. So we set a set of rules, and so if there's antitrust issues, you have to prosecute companies. We have a few companies who have antitrust issues. I don't want to mention them. There's a search company. There is an operating system company. There is a social media company. They all have antitrust issues, but there are hundreds of thousands of lawyers, it appears, that could kick the ball, you know, so to speak, down the timeline, so that, you know, they are waiting for our greatest president to return in just 6 months, and then everything will be pretty good. So we have monopolies. We have grand monopolies. You know, it's not like electricity production. These are grand monopolies. And so if you were to regulate electricity production, we would be regulating these guys much, much earlier, right? But they're not regulated. So where are we on that one?
Yeah, I talk about this quite a bit in the book. I mean, I think that what happened beginning in the 1980s on President Reagan's watch was a kind of reforming of antitrust doctrine. Whereas in earlier times, the Sherman Act and other antitrust laws were understood by courts as looking askance and looking negatively at, for example, Standard Oil, not only owning the refineries, but also owning the rail tracks and the rolling stock that took the oil or took the crude from or to the refineries and then took the refined process from the refineries. You know, that there was a big case in 1911 where that was deemed wrong and Standard Oil was broken up into smaller entities. So beginning in the 1980s and actually under Bork, under his, he was a professor at the Chicago, of the Chicago School and propagated this view that actually bigness is good. Bigness is efficient and bigness is what we want. And so all of a sudden, what antitrust law got turned on its head, in effect, and became a law that actually condoned and facilitated monopoly, which seems ironic, but that's where we were, and that's where we've been for a while. And that is why, you know, Apple or Google or Amazon can have the breadth of operations that they currently have, not to mention many other companies that aren't in the tech sector, but have massive holdings of different brands. And so the problem isn't so much that the companies have lots, have armies of lawyers. The problem is that those armies of lawyers actually have the capacity to make good arguments because the law is on their side. And again, this is a consequence of deregulation. And the solution to it is to re-regulate and to regulate deeply. And to some extent, the Federal Trade Commission is trying to kind of turn this large sort of boat with momentum going in one direction around and trying to bring back some of those old ideas about antitrust. We'll see how successful they are. But there's no question, and I document this in my book, that, you know, if Reagan was sort of a deregulation advocate, Trump was a deregulation advocate on steroids. I mean, he just his.
I'm not exactly sure if Trump knows what he is about.
Well, but who but the people that, around him, the people around him. I mean, Steve Bannon knows what Trump is about, and Steve Bannon actually said it was his ambition when he was still part of Trump's inner circle that that he would deconstruct the administrative state. So, so the program isn't just a program of xenophobia and nastiness, but the program is a program of a sort of radical diminishment of the social state and of the regulatory state, and along with it, a doubling down on the evisceration of antitrust law.
Yeah, so I'm again a little bit conflicted about this. So the larger question is, what's the objective function for society? So suppose I say I take the lowest common denominator in society, and I make policies that make that least common denominator happier. That is a good policy. I have no horse in this race. I'm not a Republican or Democrat. So if that's the case, then you know, you take the status quo, you take whatever you are given, say initial conditions, and you say, how do I make that structure better? Then the policy prescriptions could be different, right? What do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, again, I think there are little things that that help, like seeing markets as tools towards that end, as tools towards ensuring that everybody, including those who are most vulnerable and disadvantaged, are able to put food on their table, to have clean water, to have an environment that isn't a cancer cluster, to have education, to have their kids educated, to have jobs that aren't the equivalent of working 18 hours a day in a salt mine, to have recreational opportunities. I mean, it's not difficult to sort of imagine some basic things that people need and to make sure that everybody has those. And in addition, that everybody has the kind of opportunity and education to be informed and well-informed so as to acquit themselves of the responsibilities of being democratic citizens. You cannot have democracy without a pretty highly informed citizenry, and a citizenry that's informed with real information rather than fake information. And then what does that say about how we regulate social media platforms and on and on and on? Like the needs aren't that complicated. And you're an engineer. It's a question of reverse engineering from those fairly obvious things to what kinds of policies are needed. And having some measure of buy-in from the public through democratic institutions as to how to make those decisions. And then having laws in place that are enforced and courts that are fair and neutral. And, you know, it's really the model that we think we have in place, but it isn't working. I mean, the Constitution in the United States is all about those checks and balances. The system of scientific inquiry is all about creating good information. We have a beautiful education system. We have incredibly well-trained healthcare providers. Like, all the pieces are there, but what we don't have is a way of ensuring everybody can benefit from that.
Right. So there are two things here. One is sort of a structural question, which is, do we have the right structure so that, you know, that goes into democracy and all the alternative structures you can imagine. Another is, as you say in your book and what you said, there are two major things here. One is education, one is healthcare. These have wide-ranging positive effects on society. So if you really want to optimize society, you would say healthcare and education have to be free. But we are not there yet, right? So I don't know what the situation is in Canada, but in the US, we are definitely not there at all. Yeah.
I mean, I think most countries are, especially most advanced capitalist countries, have very heavily socialized systems of education. In Canada, for example, I mean, this seems like a small policy difference, but it's exactly the kind of ways that we need to think. In Canada, the funding of education comes out of provincial, or what you would call state, coffers. So revenue. So if you live in a poor region of the province or you live in a rich region of the province, you get the same funding if you're a school. In the United States, in most places, funding or a large part of funding comes out of the local tax base. So the city or even the ward within the city. So if you're living in the South Bronx, your school is going to be much worse funded than if you're living in Westchester County. So right there, that is just a very nerdy kind of technical thing, is what revenue base do you fund your schools out of? And it makes an absolutely profound difference in terms of the extent to which there's equality in the system. And again, I mean, in Canada, universities are, though this is changing, but traditionally universities are much more heavily subsidized, which means students don't have to pay as much tuition, and on and on and on. So again, Canada is putatively a capitalist society, but its healthcare is socialized, its education's more socialized, its filmmaking is socialized even. My documentary film, The New Corporation, is paid for by institutions that are taxpayer funded for the most part.
So you guys have a good looking prime minister, though, I have to say.
Well, I don't know how long
since Obama, we haven't had that. Yeah.
Well, I don't know how long that'll last. His charm seems to be wearing a little bit thin, and waiting in the wings is somebody who, in many ways, is not. It's a Canadian version of Donald Trump, I would say. More muted and more polite.
Come on.
As I say, more polite being Canadian.
Better than Donald Trump.
Well, we can only hope.
We don't want to start an argument here. So your chapter 4 here says California, bad dreaming. What is that about?
Oh, so the chapter on California Bad Dreaming is, obviously, it's a play on the famous song by the Mamas and Papas called California Dreaming. And it's basically about the tech industry. And it's about the way in which the tech industry, and I think this was before Elon Musk took over Twitter, yes. But it's about the particularly sort of vicious neoliberalism or hypercapitalism that is the ideology that drives Silicon Valley, and the sort of threat that poses, both in terms of the lobbying of the industry and also the products that the industry puts out and how it runs them in terms of social media, monopolies like Amazon and so forth, the threat that poses to democracy and to human welfare, basically. So that's that chapter. Yeah.
So you're arguing here, if I understand you correctly, you're arguing here that the technologies that come out of Silicon Valley, it's still sort of profit optimizing technologies, actually in a very grand scale profit optimizing.
Yes.
And it has negative societal effects in the long run. Yes,
I think so. I think the what they call network effects in Silicon Valley is simply a nice word for monopoly. the whole idea of network effects for Amazon, for example, is that Amazon be the place that everybody goes. It succeeds by being the place that has no competition. So that is the business model. So that if you go to Amazon, you know that all of the retailers that you might want to interface with, including Amazon itself, are going to be there. So you are going to be able to get whatever you need. You can't say that about any other online retailer. You know, maybe there's, you know, maybe Walmart has, but it's not going to be as vast. All you'll be able to get is what Walmart sells, but Amazon becomes a clearinghouse for retailers that are actually competing with Amazon, but it provides them a platform because it then draws more people because it creates network effects. Twitter creates network effects for people who are looking to have discussions about political and social life. Facebook, network effects. You know that every one of your uncles and second cousins is going to be on Facebook because everybody goes on Facebook. So the basic business model is one that depends upon monopoly. And that's not a good thing for the economy, for competition, and for democracy. There's then the further problem that the social media platforms like Facebook and like Twitter are basically engineered to make money. They're not engineered to provide a good place for people to meet and talk about things. So they're, and it's a long critique, but basically their algorithms operate in a way that ensure that the most people will come and stay and spend a lot of time there, which means often emphasizing emotionally laden, polarizing kinds of discourse, including hate discourse or other kinds of discourse that are likely to titillate people, to keep them coming back, rather than good information exchange and good information debate. Now, I have a horse in the race. You mentioned horses and races before. I'm currently suing Twitter. I'm in court. Yeah. I'm an attorney, and I'm currently suing Twitter because they actually censored my film, The New Corporation.
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm in court in Ontario, suing them at the moment. So any comments that I make have to be understood with that disclosure.
So, sort of a grander scale, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but so suppose you were the emperor of the world, 8 billion people.
Okay.
Take the status quo.
Yeah.
Status quo is we got, 1.5 billion people on Facebook. I think 700 million on Twitter. another billion on LinkedIn, all sorts of stuff going on, right? So if you were the emperor of the world today, what are sort of the policy actions you would think about?
Yeah, it's a really tough one. I mean, what I'm advocating, this is just a kind of microcosm to answer that question. What I'm advocating with respect to Twitter, in the case that I'm arguing against them, is that there needs to be some measure of judicial oversight of the platform to ensure that certain values about public discourse are not completely destroyed, like truth, like free speech, like protection of people from free speech.
It's like run by a guy who says free speech is the best thing after sliced bread.
Yeah, well, then I don't quite understand why he shut down promotion of my film on the the platform. But yeah, I think it's one thing to say something, it's another to do it. And I also think it gets back to the point we were making before about having these sort of billionaires making decisions about what certain values mean and what certain goals require. You know, I really don't care what Elon Musk thinks about free speech. Mm. I care what courts and institutions that are seized with the task of implementing our Constitution and have authority behind their interpretations of it. I care what they think about free speech. That's our system. And for a platform like Twitter, that even though it is a private platform, it is de facto, it functions as a public town square for discourse. And so I think there's a need, not necessarily for really sort of rigorous government regulation, I'm not sure that's the right thing, but at least for some measure of judicial oversight to assume it doesn't become a sort of toxic cesspool of hate and misinformation, and that it remains open to free inquiry. I mean, I think these social media platforms have become so successful that in effect they've earned the scrutiny of public institutions to make sure that they're operating in the same way that public utilities do. You know, when you electric companies and water companies, you need to regulate them because of what they're providing. Yeah.
Yeah. Even though I have a Chicago angle here, I completely agree with you. I think the surge and many of the social media companies are public utilities and should be regulated as public utilities.
Yeah.
That would be societally more beneficial, I think. You know?
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, it doesn't take a radical imagination to suggest, even if you are a subscriber to the Chicago School of View, to suggest that in a democracy, the governments that people elect have an obligation to take seriously providing legal protection and facilitation of the public good. I mean, that's just not a radical proposition. That, you know, the idea in a democracy is that the demos makes decisions about important things, and the law is the way that those decisions are implemented, whether it be legislation, regulation, common law. That's how you actually create the rule-based framework for ensuring that what the democracy has said is the public good is actually realized. And, you know, it doesn't take rocket science to see the merit of that kind of system. And then, you know, we can argue within that, well, should we go this far? Should we do that? Should we do this? But I think our fundamental problem now is that we're no longer having that argument within the boundaries of a shared set of assumptions about the viability and the desirability of things like democracy, rule of law, fair elections. We've lost that common ground. And that's where we're at. And we haven't talked about climate change yet, but I think that is an overarching, issue that sort of affects all of these